Good afternoon. My name is Melissa, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the AAAS Science Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you have already done so, please press the pound sign now. Then press star one again to ensure your question is registered. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Pinole, you may begin your conference.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today to discuss research that will appear in the journal Science Online at the Science Express website today. I'm Natasha Pinole, Senior Communications Officer in the AAAS Office of Public Programs. This embargo telebriefing is being made possible through the generosity of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the nonprofit International Science Society that publishes the journal Science, in cooperation with the International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN. A reminder that all information disclosed in this telebriefing will remain embargoed until 6:30 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time or 11:30 p.m. British Summer Time today, Tuesday, the 26th of October, 2010. The embargo is lifting in advance of a press conference at the 10th Conference of the Parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity in Nagoya, Japan. On the line with me are Dr. Andrew Sugden, Deputy Editor of the Journal Science from our Cambridge, UK office, and our speakers, who will each give about three-minute summaries of their primary conclusions. Unfortunately, the lead author, Dr. Mike Hoffman, has been taken ill and is unavailable, and we wish him a speedy recovery. The title of this paper is The Impact of Conservation on the Status of the World's Vertebrates, and the speakers who will be presenting today are Dr. Stuart Butchard, Global Research Coordinator at BirdLife International in the UK, Dr. Craig Hilton-Taylor, Manager of the IUCN Red List Unit in the UK, Dr. Anna Rodriguez from the Centre d'Écologie Fonctionnelle et Évolutive in Montpellier, France, and Dr. Nicholas Dolvey, Co-Chair of the IUCN Shark Specialist Group in Canada. Dr. Sugden will first comment on science's perspective in publishing this research. Then the authors will participate in the question and answer session following their opening statements. Thanks again for joining us. Andrew?
Good morning, good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for joining us. I'm Andrew Sugden, Deputy Editor for Biology at Science Magazine, based at our office in Cambridge, UK. To go straight in, and very briefly, the question we're addressing today is, does wildlife conservation work? And to answer this, Mike Hoffman and his colleagues have drawn on the results of five decades' worth of data on the status of the world vertebrates. This survey that they've carried out covers more than 25,000 species, which is about half the world's total of vertebrate species. And the long-term trends that they find using the IUCN's Red List Index methodology now show a now familiar general pattern of decline. But nonetheless, the survey shows that the declines would have been about 18% worse in the absence of conservation actions taken in recent decades. And hence, even though, as we've been hearing, the Convention on Biological Diversity's target for 2010 hasn't been met, this work provides good evidence that conservation actions can work, and that if stepped up, there are still realistic hopes of reducing the impacts of some of the drivers of the biodiversity decline. At Science, we're delighted to be publishing this unusually comprehensive study on a topic of global importance. And as I've said before on similar occasions, long-term research and data collection is absolutely essential for understanding ecological phenomena and human impact on the global environment and its biodiversity. And this paper is a really notable example of that. And it's also a demonstration of the value of a coordinated global research effort involving, in this case, nearly 200 authors from almost 40 countries. And with that, I'd now like to hand over to Stuart Butchart on behalf of the authors to explain their research in more depth and to answer your questions. So many thanks again, and over to you, Stuart.
Thanks, Andrew. So I'm going to give a little bit of background for this paper. And the context is really that biodiversity, the variety of genes, populations, species, and ecosystems that constitute life on Earth, underpins our lives. And that's because we derive a wealth of economic benefits and services from biodiversity, things like clean drinking water, pollination and pest control for crops, climate regulation, flood control, and things like this. And these ecosystem services, as they're called, have been estimated to be worth $33 trillion a year. That's 10 times the size of the UK's GDP, for example. But biodiversity is being destroyed at a rapid pace by human activities. The world's governments recognise this and 2 decades ago set up the Convention on Biological Diversity under the United Nations. In 2002, they set themselves a target to significantly reduce the rate of biodiversity loss by 2010, this year, the so-called 2010 target. And a wealth of data, including a paper that we at BirdLife International, along with colleagues in more than 30 other institutions, published in Science earlier this year, show that we failed to meet that target, and the natural world is being destroyed faster than ever. While governments have made some efforts to tackle biodiversity loss, these responses have been woefully inadequate, and the gulf between the threats to biodiversity and the government actions is growing ever wider. And in this context, world leaders are now meeting in Nagoya in Japan for the 10th conference of the convention. And they're discussing reasons for failure to meet the 2010 targets and are negotiating a revised plan and new targets for 2020 for tackling biodiversity loss. So our paper is therefore extremely timely because we document just how severe the situation is for vertebrates, the species of greatest interest to people, but also show that the situation is not futile and that the loss of populations and species, along with the benefits we accrue from them, can be halted and reversed. And we do this using information from the IUCN Red List that Andrew referred to. And this is the most comprehensive and objective system for categorizing species in terms of their risk of extinction. And thousands of scientists have assessed over 50,000 species for the Red List now, using a set of criteria with quantitative thresholds for population and range, size and trends, to assign species to categories of extinction risk, and these range from least concern through to critically endangered and extinct. And by looking at groups of species that have been assessed on multiple occasions over time, we can track trends in their status. And this forms the basis of our paper. So I'm now going to hand over to Craig Hilton-Taylor, who works in the Red List program, who's going to summarize the key results from the first part of the paper.
Thanks, Hugh, and good day, everyone. As Andrew and Stu have said, for the past 15 years, IUCN and its partners have been working together to collate and publish information on the status of the world's plant and animal species. And with the help of more than 3,000 experts worldwide, we now have the most comprehensive picture of what is happening to the world's vertebrates. These include the animals that people are most familiar with and tend to care the most about, especially the animals, the mammals, and the birds. And this report is essentially the first global audit, if you like, of this group of organisms, and it very clearly shows that we are not taking good care of our natural capital, because the report shows that 1 in 8 birds are threatened with extinction, 1 in 7 of the bony fishes, 1 in 4 mammals, 1 in 4 reptiles threatened with extinction, 1 in 3 amphibians, 1 in 3 sharks. So overall, from all these figures, we know that of the 26,000 species of vertebrates that we've looked at least 1/5 of them are threatened with extinction in the near future. More worrying is that when we look at the trends and status of species over time, we find that there are more species moving towards extinction or even becoming extinct than there are species which are recovering and becoming safer. So why do we have so many threatened species, and why is the situation becoming worse? It's largely because of the ever-growing demands of people. We have the usual but increasingly amplified threats of agricultural expansion and agricultural intensification around the world, especially planting of new commercial crops for biofuels. We have the logging of forests for timber and fuel, expansion of industrial and residential areas, unsustainable hunting and fishing, and the ever-increasing impacts of invasive species. But to add to this, we now have the emergence of new and novel threats, like, for example, the spread of the infectious fungal disease Clostridiomycosis, which has caused dramatic declines in many amphibian species, especially in parts of South America and Australia. We have already observed the impacts of climate change related to bleaching events and coral reefs. As we gain a better understanding of the impacts of climate change on species, we know that the situation is set to become even bleaker. But it's not all doom and gloom, and I'll now hand over to Anna Rodriguez to explain that there are optimistic ways forward.
Thank you, Craig, and thank you, everybody. Indeed, all of these bad news can be extremely disheartening and give the impression that conservation efforts are being wasted. Indeed, we every year we spend millions of dollars in conservation. We have a very large network of protected areas in many parts of the world already. They cover now more than 12% of the planet's land surface. And yet we don't seem to be able to reverse the rate of biodiversity loss. We have missed the 2010 biodiversity target. But what our results show is that conservation efforts are not wasted. They are making a noticeable difference. It would be even worse in the absence of those conservation efforts. Indeed, the rate of decline in the Red List Index that has been mentioned before would have been at least 18% steeper, 18% worse. And this is an underestimate, because we only looked at cases where species improved in status due to conservation action. We did not look at the many more species for which conservation action has prevented them from getting worse, and they could have deteriorated in the absence of conservation. What else could be highlighted is some amazing conservation success stories, including as many species that would have been extinct in the absence of conservation. Some of the best-known examples include the black-footed ferret in the United States, the golden lion tamarind in Brazil, the Mauritius kestrel in the small island nation of Mauritius, species that just a couple of decades ago they were pretty much considered doomed, and that thanks to focused conservation action are now well on the way to recovery. Overall, we're getting quite good at dealing with some types of threats. For example, we're getting better and better at eradicating invasive species, invasive predators from small islands. We also developed relatively good captive breeding techniques that bias time while we sort out, for example, protected areas to prevent habitat loss or sort out local legislation to avoid hunting. But most parts of the world, these conservation actions are still too limited when compared to the magnitude of the threats. It's therefore time to scale up conservation efforts, to step up to the challenge. I will now introduce you Nick Dolville, who will be presenting the marine perspective on our study.
And while most of our information comes from terrestrial ecosystems and the land around us, we have to bear in mind that 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by oceans. And the findings from the marine realm illustrate the magnitude of the challenges that and the problems faced by human population growth over the planet. While we've been farming land for over 10,000 years, we've only really seriously started to exploit the world's oceans, particularly in the last 50 years, and now we're moving into the new frontier of the deep seas. We've already heard how 3/4 of the world's fisheries are overexploited. We've already heard about the vast quantities of animal biomass that has been removed, particularly from the top of coastal and ocean food webs. The key question has really been, what are the consequences of this biomass removal for threat and extinction risk in the oceans? And here we show for the first time that 1 in 7 bony fishes are threatened, and indeed 1 in 3 of all world sharks, rays, and chimeras are threatened. Many of these fishes are threatened not because they are the target of fisheries. Indeed, they are the largely unseen and unmonitored collateral damage of fisheries. While our understanding of threat and extinction risk in our oceans is sparse, this study provides the first snapshot of the status of marine vertebrate biodiversity and provides the stepping stone towards the development of indicators that can be used to monitor progress towards halting the loss of biodiversity. The key and overwhelming threat to marine biodiversity is overexploitation. However, we know the key actions and answers to mitigate this threat, in particular, reduction in fishing mortality, the reduction in bycatch, simple catch monitoring, trying to find out what is actually being caught, are simple and key solutions to this problem. Indeed, in the marine realm, we have some fantastic examples of what can be achieved with international cooperation. Both the blue whale and, in particular, the humpback whale have recovered as a result of the cessation of whaling in 1966 as a direct result of the activities of the International Whaling Commission. The United Nations ban on pelagic drift netting in the Pacific in 1992 has saved the salmon shark. This species was a major catch of these squid fisheries, but has recently been assessed as being of least concern. These examples of marine conservation echo other examples from conservation on land and highlight what can be achieved if countries join forces together to achieve a common conservation goal.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now we'll open the call for a question and answer session with the authors. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue.
We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Joe Hall with Toronto Star.
Hello. You list a number of usual suspect conditions that are causing these threatening conditions. How much, so it might be caused by the loss of species themselves affecting another species in the chain and the food chain are that kind of thing?
Hi, this is Stuart Butchart. Well, it's certainly true that as communities of species get disrupted through the declines of their companion species, this will have knock-on effects on others, either through the food supply or through predation or through competition or other interactions. But the primary driver of species declines leading to species becoming threatened with extinction are human activities directly. So typically it's the loss and degradation of the habitats, but also direct mortality resulting from some threats like the bycatch that that Nick Dalby was referring to, or from pollution, for example. It's really the those impacts that are much more important than the knock-on consequences through other species in the way that your question was addressing.
Thank you.
And just Craig Hill-Taylor, just to follow up on that. So as Stu says, you know, we haven't really shown much of that in the vertebrates, but if you look at the insects in the plant world, there will be many cases like that as we start to do more assessments. So in particular with loss of pollinators, many plant species will start to disappear from the planet.
Your next question comes from Malcolm Ritter with Associated Press.
Hi, thank you very much. The study says that about a fifth of vertebrate species are threatened. I guess two questions. First of all, is that number a surprise, or is that what you would have guessed? And secondly, can you please define what you mean by threatened?
Craig, do you want to take that one?
Craig Hilton-Taylor. So what do we mean by threatened? First of all, we have a set of categories that we classify all species against. So every single species within a whole group that we looked at, like the birds or the mammals, is assigned to a category. Least concerned are the ones we're not really that worried about. They are fairly secure. But the threatened ones are what we call, or we list as either critically endangered, endangered, or vulnerable. So they are the ones that are close to going extinct in the near future. And then the first part of your question, one-fifth, is that a surprise? I guess not really a surprise, because we've known for a while that death was could be the figure, but the first time we've been able to bring all the data together. We haven't had information on many of the fish and reptile species for a while, so we weren't sure what the final figure would be. But more worrying is that that figure is going to get worse with time.
Thank you.
This is Stuart Burchard again. It's perhaps also worth mentioning that we were able to compare the proportion of species threatened with extinction within the vertebrate groups with a number of other plant and invertebrate groups, so corals, crayfish, dragonflies, conifers, and so on. And the levels of threat are not dissimilar in those other groups, ranging up to about 60% for cycads in a particular ancient plant group. But amongst the others, we're looking at sort of a quarter to a third to 40% or so. So the results for the vertebrates are likely to be representative of other groups.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Peter Spatz with Christian Science Monitor.
Well, thank you very much for doing this, particularly given the time zone differences here. what if anything, are you finding out about the, what I guess I want to say, maybe the wrong way to phrase it, the genetic health of the populations that are conserved? We've seen here recently, for example, of the Florida panther, that the habitats are so fragmented that in order to try and maintain genetic viability in the populations, they're going to have to continue to import periodically, you know, similar panthers from elsewhere in the southeastern U.S. for breeding purposes. I noticed that, if I read correctly, one of the, was it the kestrel from Mauritius, started out with four birds and is now a population of 1,000, but which is numerically good news. Is there a genetic concern in here as well?
I can try and address that again, Stuart Butchart. We have relatively little data on the genetics for many of these species, but it doesn't seem to be such a concern in many cases as you might expect. So, for example, with the Mauritian kestrel and a number of these small island species that have become reduced to very small population sizes, they probably naturally evolved to go through population fluctuations in the past. So they've probably been through past bottlenecks, as it's termed. And they seem to be suffering less from the sorts of genetic problems that that your question implied than one might expect. But it's certainly true that this is a concern and one that we need better information on.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can just step in on that something. I'm Anna Rodriguez, and just related to your very excellent question is the fact that here we're just looking at species extinction, but of course a species going extinct is just the last individual dying, and often way before that what we have is the extinction of populations, where the you're losing genetic diversity, you're losing species range, sometimes slowly, sometimes under the radar, so that we don't actually realize how much we're losing. And we do know that in great parts of the world now, diversity of fauna and flora is vastly impoverished, not just in terms of species richness, but also in terms of biomass. And again, the oceans are an excellent example of that, where we've lost vast amounts of populations, of individuals, of biomass. And some of those losses are not necessarily captured by the red list. The red list is, in a sense, quite coarse. It just shows you where things are really, the entire species is pretty much getting close to the brink, which is why it's so scary that the results look as bad as they do, because it's actually a coarse indicator. If there are indicators like the Living Planet Index that look at declines at the population level, in terms of numbers of individuals, the declines are much steeper.
Thank you.
As a reminder,
just to add to that, so as Stu says, some species have gone to very low numbers and have recovered remarkably well without the loss of much genetic diversity. But there are many other species, especially ones that are congregatory, that come together for sort of mass breeding, which if they get reduced down to a certain level, they go through what they call a alley effect or a deforestation effect, where there's a genetic impact and then the population just crashes at that point. And that's a classic example of what happened to the passenger pigeon in North America and what's happening to some of our marine species.
As a reminder, when you are asking your question, please state your question loud and clear. Your next question comes from Diana Sagidra with Reforma Newspaper.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to know, could you give us some examples of the species that advanced to extinction, and how did you see the force of conservation in countries like Mexico, host of Mexico 16?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that question.
Yes.
Could you repeat it, please?
Yes. Our questions. Could you give us some examples of species that advanced extinction? And the other one is, how did you see the efforts of conservation in countries like Mexico, host of next COP 16?
I'm not very sure about the question. Was it examples of species that were close to extinction and which have recovered? Is that what your question?
Diana, maybe if you could send me an email quickly to scipac@aaas.org, and then I can repeat it. I think the audio level, there's difficulty hearing because of the audio level. Hello?
I can move on to the next question.
Yes, operator, we'll take the next question, please. Your next question comes from Tim Duchant with Ars Technica.
Yes, hi. Thanks for doing this. My question is, I noticed there was more extinction risk in Southeast Asia than in South America's Atlantic forest. I was wondering if you could describe how these two regions are different in terms of extinction risk.
Andrew Rodriguez again. So there's different aspects here. I'm not sure if you're looking at the maps. So there's, mm-hmm. there's two maps. One, it will tell you the sort of figure two, I guess, will tell you numbers of threatened species, while figure four will tell you basically increase in threat levels. And you'll see that in both cases, Southeast Asia comes up in red in both cases. It comes up very dark in both of them. And it means two things. Not only that Southeast Asia now is the world's leading concentration or one of the most important concentrations of currently threatened species, it's also an area where you have the most acceleration in the rates of threat. And that is a reality, and it comes from for several groups. We see that effect. It's a result of a multiplication of threats, and particularly in Southeast Asia's habitat loss. It is also the case that the Atlantic forest is the region of high levels of threat, of high fragmentation of high species, high levels of species, of endemic species with very small ranges, and a lot of the habitat has been lost. Somehow, the Atlantic forest seems to have been able to establish a set of protected areas where species have somehow stabilized a bit more. In Southeast Asia, currently, the losses are quite rampant, and it's a combination of habitat loss and over-exploitation. There's a lot of consumption of pretty much all taxa for medicinal trade, food, pet trade. It's an area of much higher human density than the Atlantic forest, so the challenges are much bigger.
But this is Stuart Butchart again. It's a good question in that those two areas are really two of the major hotspots of concern. There are some key differences in the drivers. So in Southeast Asia, it's particularly the expansion of commercial oil palm plantations that is driving rapid deforestation. Whereas in the Atlantic Forest, it's a mixture of different forms of agriculture, including a lot of small-scale and subsistence agriculture, but increasingly the expansion of soya, of course. And as Anna hints, over-exploitation in the form of hunting and capture for birds for the trade. For cage birds is a much, much bigger issue in Southeast Asia than the Atlantic Forest as a sort of gross generalization.
Great, thank you.
Okay, well, we'll take another question, please.
Okay, your next question comes from Emily Tong with CBC.
My question is, you mentioned that most threatened species are in tropical areas, and I was wondering what temperate countries, Western nations, such as Canada, be paying attention to in particular.
So Canada, for example, it does have one species which is actually quite unique. It's the Vancouver Island marmot, which declined from endangered to critical over the period of our analysis, and it's actually very close to extinction. So this species alone is driving Canada's score low, despite the fact that it's a country with much more capacity to do conservation, and also with less challenges in the sense that it has population density is not that high, and a lot of the species are more of the species are widespread, so they have more opportunities for conservation. It still has this species shining as a bad news example. And if you email us, I'm happy to give you more information about particular species.
Stuart Burchard again, but perhaps looking more broadly, Canada's impact on the rest of the world is a significant driver of the deteriorating status of biodiversity. In Western countries, our levels of consumption are so high that it's our demand that is causing deforestation, the intensifying agriculture, the production of commodities that we're consuming that are leading to the land use change and the threats to biodiversity in the tropics, which is where most species are found.
Would any of the other authors like to respond to the question?
Eric Hilton-Taylor, just agree with what Stu Bochart said there, and just to point out that the northern European countries generally have very low mammal diversity, but there are certain mammals which are a conservation concern, and there are good conservation programs underway. But there is the issue of northern European countries and the demand for resources and the impact that has on other parts, the tropical parts of the world.
Okay.
Can I add something in?
This is
Nick Dolby, based in Vancouver. So Canada has shown great leadership in conservation over the past few decades and was one of the first signatories of the Convention on Biological Diversity. And Canada nationally implements species protection through the Species at Risk Act. And about 85% of species that get assessed by its assessment body actually end up being protected under the Species at Risk Act. However, this is not the case for the marine environment, and Canada does still need to show much more leadership in the protection of marine species, and indeed needs to implement the Species at Risk Act to marine species.
And just to throw in one final comment, Stuart Burchard again. Right now, the negotiations are going on in Nagoya in Japan they're trying to agree an ambitious new and workable strategy for biodiversity conservation for 2020. At the moment, the discussions are somewhat going around in circles, partly because Canada and the EU are blocking a binding treaty against biopiracy. So this is about developing nations benefiting from industry profits derived from genetic resources in their countries. And if that protocol doesn't get agreed, it looks like there's going to be very limited progress on all the on topics. So Canada's playing a particularly obstructive role at the moment in those negotiations, which could be disastrous for biodiversity globally.
Hi, Emily. Do you have any further follow-up questions?
No, that's good. Thank you very much.
Did our Mexican colleague get her question?
Yes, she sent in her questions here. She has a few questions. She would like to know some examples of species that are becoming extinct, if you could estimate how many species could be lost due to climate change. What about the new species daily found in the world? Let's see here. How do you see the efforts of conservation in countries like Mexico, host of the next COP16? And finally, how these results could influence the objectives of the UN to stop the species from extinction.
Maybe I can, Ana Rodriguez, maybe I can just give an general overview of how things look like in Mexico. They look pretty bad, I'm afraid. Mexico, in terms of if we look at the overall performance of individual countries, basically their share of the contribution towards these global losses, Mexico comes out pretty badly. It has a lot of endemic species, particularly of amphibians, and a lot of them are disappearing very fast. Some of it is habitat loss. Good part of it will be habitat loss, but it also is new disease that's slipping through Central America, which basically is leading to the population crashes of amphibians, even in areas where they're well protected. So, while in some cases it's something that Mexico, in a sense, alone can do, which is to get good protected areas working, and in others it requires international cooperation between scientists, politicians, land managers to actually try to find a solution to this situation of the amphibians. For many species, it's looking like they need to be. Populations, rescue populations need to be created where they are safeguarded in captivity while we try to find out a way to deal with this disease, chytrid fungus, in the wild, because currently we don't have a solution for this problem. I'm happy to send more detailed information on the Mexico situation with examples of species, but a lot of them would be amphibians.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rodriguez.
Just to balance that with a positive story, in the last few years, Mexico has banned the capture and export of wild parrots. So Mexico used to be a major source country for parrots in the international cage bird trade. There are many species of parrots that are threatened with extinction partly because of that threat. So this is a positive step forward. What's really important now is that along with other policy responses to biodiversity loss, these laws are effectively implemented on the ground to ensure that the trade really does stop.
Okay, thank you. Do we have another question?
Yes, your next.
Operator? Okay, great.
Your next question comes from Margaret Monroe with Post Media News.
Hello, thanks for doing this. I want to ask about the negotiations in Japan, and I wonder if you could be a bit more specific of what you'd like to come out of this meeting, like in terms of beyond just scaling things up, like how much do we need to scale things up? Do we need to like double the amount of protected areas or what? And also, what happens if this fails? Like, it doesn't look like things are going good over there, and I'm just wondering, are we going to be looking at another 10-20% species loss or threats if there is no agreement?
So, Stuart Butchart here. Well, my colleagues at BirdLife International, who are in Japan at the meetings at the moment, are arguing that there are five key things that the conference must do. And they are firstly adopting strong and ambitious targets for 2020, which link conservation to human well-being and go well beyond business as usual. There must be an increase in funding for biodiversity conservation of at least tenfold so that every country has the resources to implement the convention. The protected area network needs to be expanded, in particular to cover sites of particular importance for biodiversity. We need to go beyond simple percentages of coverage of the terrestrial or marine surface and target these protected areas much more effectively. Fourthly, there needs to be agreement on a legally binding protocol for fair and equitable sharing of benefits, the thing I was referring to earlier on. And finally, the convention needs to work much more closely with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And those five components are needed if we're to seriously tackle biodiversity loss in the coming years. If the conference fails to reach agreement, then I think things are looking pretty bleak for the coming years. I think we have to hope that politicians will realise that this is a make or break time, and it's really critical that agreement is reached.
Craig Rosenthaler, just to add to what Stuart Butchart said there, I think one of the things that all of our organizations agree with is that currently the current economic and social systems that we have around the world fail to value biodiversity resources properly. And we really need the new strategic plan from the CBD to address that and come up with a new set of systems to properly value biodiversity.
So just to sort of to bring it back to our paper, what we're doing in this publication is providing further information on the seriousness of the biodiversity crisis, but also showing that conservation solutions can work. And this should really add impetus to the efforts of governments currently negotiating in Nagoya. It's critical that agreement is reached. Governments must make strong commitments to then turn those commitments into concrete actions.
Welcome back to that, Ana Rodriguez. It's not just a matter, just to reiterate what Stuart has said, it's not just a matter of increasing the level of efforts, the magnitude of funding, for example. It's about strategic implementation of those efforts. A lot of these changes come from, a lot of these losses come from a quite small fraction of the world, a quite small fraction of countries, and within countries from particular regions. We actually do have a lot of information that would allow us to use the resources we have in a much more efficient way. It is that currently there's no level of global cooperation needed to ensure that the resources actually are invested in parts of the world that need them the most. So that's the importance of these international negotiations, is to try to get people to cooperate.
Hello, operator?
Yes.
It looks like we lost Dr. Rodriguez.
Hello.
Hello? Okay. You're back again. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Okay, operator, we'll take another question, please.
Okay, your next question comes from Dan Vergano with USA Today.
Hey, thanks again for doing this. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about conservation as a solution. There's two things we hear from readers. One is that conservation is a luxury given the world economy right now. And the other thing we sometimes hear is, if these animals are going extinct, then, it's a losing game to just throw more money at conservation. I was wondering if you could talk to either of those points or both.
So on the first one, this is Joe Burchard. It's absolutely true that we're in a particularly difficult financial and economic time at the moment, but there is no other area where the investment of public money makes so much sense and meets so many of the strategic interests of governments. Economists have calculated that not stepping up our efforts on biodiversity loss will cost us 7% of the global GDP by 2050. That doesn't even include the consequences of resource conflicts, refugees, political instabilities, and those kind of things that will happen when ecosystems reach tipping points of collapse. So, yes, there are lots of demands on the public purse at the moment, but spending on biodiversity makes economic sense both in the short and long term.
Just to follow up, I've heard from some people that a lot has been learned about conservation in the last 10 years. Is, what's your sense of that? Are you better at it now than you were when you sort of started this effort?
Yes, definitely. I think our capacity to reverse biodiversity trends, to bring species back from the brink of extinction, is greater than ever before. And the suite of successes that we can point to shows that we have the skills and the knowledge. But what is required are the resources and the political will, which together can improve the outlook for biodiversity.
Just to add something in relation to your previous point, Ana Rodriguez, you put to the suggestion that, well, because we're not being able to achieve these aims and reverse these losses, maybe it's just wasted money. And this is precisely the message we're trying to get. There's a big message trying to come out of this paper, is to reverse that idea that if we can't achieve all, therefore it's a waste. It isn't. The fact that we couldn't reverse the rates of loss and therefore meet the 2010 target doesn't mean that conservation was wasted. It made a difference. It would have been worse in the absence of that conservation investment. So if I were to tell you that we were not able to reach different targets of eliminating poverty from the world, but nonetheless it was reduced by 50%, it wouldn't necessarily be a waste. It just means that you don't meet the target, but you still made a difference. And that's the main message of this paper, is to show that even though we're not being able to reverse the trends yet because the investment is not sufficient and not sufficiently strategic, it is making a difference in global rates of biodiversity loss. So conservation is working, it's just not enough.
Thank you very much.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. Your next question comes from Teresita Quezada with La Tercera newspaper.
Hello. First, thanks. My question is, in which of the American countries are more species threatened, and what are the main reasons for that? And how is Chile in that map?
So
great.
The main
questions.
Go on, Anna. Go on.
The main countries that are coming up as having given the most contribution to these rates of decline. So it's not necessarily the ones with more threatened species, but the ones where most of these declines have happened are Indonesia, not surprisingly, Malaysia, Mexico, we already discussed Colombia, China, but and Ecuador, but actually not somehow, perhaps a bit surprisingly, also the United States and Australia. So it's not just the poor countries where these changes are happening. In the United States, for example, most of the losses are in Hawaii. Mainland is doing better, but in Hawaii it's currently probably the extinction hotspot, at least for birds of the world. So it's not just a matter of being developing countries, it's a matter of making sure the resources are being used strategically and addressing the threats which are affecting species. I can, if you email me, I will send you a detailed overview of what's happening with Chile. Chile is also has also declined. I can give you more information species by species if you would email me.
Just for birds, for an example, Chile ranks 24th in the world for the number of threatened species. Many of those are found in the high Andes, of course. But actually, the Juan Fernandez Archipelago off the coast of Chile is a critical biodiversity hotspot. It has two bird species that are critically endangered, the Juan Fernandez Firecrown and the Massafuera Reyedito. And these are both only found on single islands. And therefore the protection of the remaining habitat and the conservation of those species is essential in order to prevent them being lost globally because they have such restricted ranges.
Craig Hilton-Taylor, just to point out that the map that we have in our report shows that the Andean countries have high levels of threatened vertebrates. And that's because of the amphibians and the impact of this fungal disease on species that occur in the Andean Mountains. And so a lot of those countries, Chile, Ecuador, Colombia, are coming through quite highly there because of this fungal disease that's impacting amphibians throughout that region.
Your next question comes from Lorena Dusman with El Mercurio.
Hello, hi. I would like to know if you can say where the around the world the best conservation results and what are the key points in those conservation programs. Thank you.
The two examples, again from the bird world, are Mauritius and Seychelles, that are real shining beacons of conservation success, and they have implemented concerted actions over the last couple of decades, tackling the conservation of a suite of species in both of these island nations that were very close to extinction, reduced to just handfuls of individuals. And if they've been able to bring these species back from the brink of extinction through a combination of conservation efforts, tackling the key threats, many of which involved invasive alien species, in combination with habitat degradation, and they are inspiring examples of how a country can reverse the fortunes of biodiversity within its borders. It has to be said that both are small island nation states, and conservation in such situations is sometimes more tractable than the challenges faced by Brazil or the Andean countries or Indonesia or some of the other ones that we've mentioned through the course of this conversation, where there are much broader scale challenges from large scale habitat loss and a whole suite of threats affecting very large numbers of threatened species.
Just to highlight there how our
conservation tactics have been changing as a result of how the challenges change as well. Most bird species which have become extinct historically in the past 500 years were extinct from islands, small island nations precisely like Mauritius and Seychelles, which had the particularly vulnerable fauna which had evolved without predators. So a few decades ago, they were the main challenges. They were where everything was happening, where all these species were, some already going extinct and some already extinct and some going extinct, as the case, for example, of Mauritius, where six endemic bird species were all very close to extinction, some just reduced to a few dozen or even less individuals. And now we see them as relatively easy. They weren't easy. There were a lot of work went into conserving those species, but in a sense they are now relatively easy because now the wave of extinction has moved from islands to the continents, and now it's in continents is where most of the biodiversity is, or big islands like Indonesia or the Philippines, where we have most diversity. And as the threats have moved from the small islands to the continents, now is when we're having the massive impact on biodiversity. And we have to step up our conservation tactics accordingly. But here's just a reminder that things that now seem relatively easy were actually not that easy just a few decades ago.
Thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad.
I think we have time for another two more questions.
Your next question comes from Malcolm Ritter with Associated Press.
Okay, thank you. I'm really embarrassed to ask this question, but I'll go ahead. For Ana Rodriguez, can you give me an English translation of the name of the place where you work?
It's the Center for Evolutionary and Functional Ecology.
Center for Evolutionary and Functional Ecology.
Ecology,
and that's in Montpellier. And that's
we like easy questions.
Yes, I thought that would be one of the better, easier ones today. That's in Montpellier?
Yes, Montpellier, France.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from Jeremy Sue with LiveScience.com.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking the time to do this. So maybe this is a pretty broad question, but I'm curious how you think conservation efforts can make that bridge between the targets set by the Convention on Biological Diversity and the sort of necessary action that needs to be taken by the individual countries. And I do have follow-up if I have time.
I'm not sure I quite understand the question. Sorry, could you...
Okay, so I guess what I'm wondering is how in your minds, you think there can be sort of a bridge between the targets that you're hoping the Convention on Biological Diversity will set and the sort of necessary action that needs to be taken by individual countries to, you know, meet those sort of broader targets.
So through the convention, sorry, this is Joe Burchard again.
Sure.
Through the convention, countries are developing national biodiversity strategies and action plans, which spell out nation by nation what actions they see as the priorities and how they plan to implement them in order to meet the objectives of the convention. And they now report to the CBD on progress against those national biodiversity strategies and action plans. More generally, whilst the 2010 target was this very broad, overarching, let's significantly reduce the rate of biodiversity loss, for 2020, the targets that are currently being negotiated, there are 20 of them, and they're much more focused and specific. So, for example, specifically aiming to increase the proportion of the land and sea surface covered by protected areas targeted to key sites, or focusing specifically on trying to reduce the rate of loss of particular habitats. So they should be much more tractable in terms of turning into focused actions to meet each of the individual targets, certainly much more so than the very broad overarching 2010 target.
Okay.
Something to that, perhaps Anna Rodriguez. Your question raises the very important point, which is it's not just a solution that will fit everywhere in the same way. What the regular state gives us is information on what needs to be done where. We have different types of threats acting on different species in different places, and in some places what needs to be done is to reduce habitat loss, perhaps through the implementation of protected areas, and that's, for example, definitely the case in Southeast Asia. In other places it might be that we need to find a solution to the disease that is affecting a particular species. In other places it might be to avoid, to reduce levels of exploitation of particular species. That's certainly the case in many marine systems. So what we need is tailored solutions to particular problems. It's not just one solution that will work everywhere in the same way.
And Craig Hilton Taylor, so when we presented the Redis information to the world, we very much recognized that action needs to happen at various scales. Some of it could be global, but it has to go right down to the local level, to even to the community level, where conservation actions have to happen at that very detailed scale to get the right sort of conservation impact.
Thanks very much. Do I have time for a quick follow-up?
Yes, Jeremy, you do.
Okay, thanks. So just given that the U.S. is currently an observer in Nagoya, how do you see, or what would you like to see from the U.S. in that sense, just because it hasn't exactly ratified the convention?
That's an interesting question. I guess we would like to see the U.S. to sign up to the convention and show leadership in the field of biodiversity conservation in the way that they have in many other sectors of sort of current socio-politics. I think demonstrating. Sorry, go on.
But we also recognize that although the U.S. may not be a party to the CBD, they do play a really crucial role around the world in terms of investing in conservation efforts globally.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the classic example for within the U.S. is the appalling extinction hotspot of Hawaii, where there are a very large number of species that have recently gone extinct and a suite of species that are teetering on the brink of extinction right in America's backyard, in particular as a consequence of alien invasive species, invasive diseases, exacerbated by climate change now. And there's woefully little awareness in the U.S. of just how important their global responsibility is for the suite of biodiversity that's extremely highly threatened. And if the U.S. could do one thing, it would be to show leadership and properly tackle, get serious about tackling the conservation issues in Hawaii.
Okay. Yeah, thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Your next question comes from Teresita Quesada. This will be our last question. Lada Sierra newspaper.
Hello. My question is, which kind of species are more threatened? For example, birds or from the sea or I don't know how to call it, but walking animals. Which ones are more threatened? That's the question.
We're looking at the vertebrate groups that we've assessed so far. The amphibians and the sharks and their relatives come out very highly threatened compared to the other groups like mammals or birds.
Hello, Teresita.
Does that answer your question?
I believe their line disconnected.
Okay. All right. I just want to ask the authors if you would like to say any closing remarks. Otherwise, I will close the call.
I guess just to sort of reiterate that our overall message is that our results should be a timely wake-up call to governments in Nagoya. Biodiversity is in a desperate state. its situation is getting worse, and that's having impacts on people all around the planet. But our results show that we can turn the situation around. We just need greater political will and resources, and governments must make strong commitments in Nagoya and turn those commitments into concrete actions on the ground to tackle biodiversity loss.
Thank you, Dr. Butchard. Shall we close the call, or did anyone else wish to say anything? Okay. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, I want to thank the panelists for participating today and the reporters. A reminder that the paper and related materials are embargoed until today, Tuesday, the 26th of October, 6:30 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Audio files and a transcript of this briefing will be posted on the SciPac website this afternoon, where the paper and related materials are housed. If you have any further questions, please contact me or the Science Press team at 202-326-6440. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.